for the, our author presenting, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to, I want you to stay there, and I'm going to stay here, to Senator Nelson, and we will bring up the bill that we had, we laid on the table yesterday by virtue on the Board of School Administrators. It had been introduced yesterday, and it needs a day before we take action. This was the bill, I might remind you, that the administrators are making consistent the requirement to pay the fees, the licensure fees for all of the administrators that support the Board of Administration. So I think we had discussion and appeared ready to vote.
Just a logistics question, Madam Chair.
Senator Thompson.
You're the Madam Chair, sorry. This was introduced yesterday. It is alive because did it pass through the House? Is that what is the?
No, we really can't, by rules, take action on a bill that was just introduced that day. That's why we're waiting today, and I'm bringing it up just to take action.
Right, but.
But you're asking about the deadlines?
Senator Olson.
Yeah.
Well, this is the second bill deadline. I'm not sure. Where is this in the House?
It's on the floor.
It's on the floor in the House. So
that makes it alive here? Is that
yes, but we should act on it today.
So, Senator Olson, did you wish to remove your bill from the table?
Yes. Madam Chair, I'd move that
Senate File
2535 be taken from the table.
Is there any more discussion on Senate File 2535? Seeing none. All those in favor of Senate File 2535 be recommended to pass.
No, be taken from the table first.
Oh, excuse me. Be taken from the table. Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. Senator Olson.
Then I would move that Senate File 2535 be recommended to pass. And does it need to go to finance?
Yes, it should.
Yes, and I believe be referred to finance committee.
Members, is there any further discussion on Senator Olson's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. We have the first on the agenda, Senator DeCryfe. While we were waiting for you, we just acted on the Board of Administration bill that we had dealt with yesterday, other than to vote. So, Senate File 1909, Senator DeCryfe will be presenting to us. And I want to say before we begin that I intend to lay this bill on the table for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, but rather than taking a vote today. So we will focus our attention on the education provisions of this bill, and we'll take testimony regarding that. But Senator DeCryfe, why don't you present it?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A-12 amendment.
Senator DeCryfe moves the Senate File 1909 and is offering the A-12 amendment, which would be an author's amendment. I believe this is the first hearing the bill has had. Do we have that in our packet? Or Senator DeCryfe, Which amendment is that?
That's my amendment.
What did she say about the vote?
The offering?
She's going to table it.
Why don't you put it on the bill? I'd love
to
have it. Do it, sure.
What's that?
If you'd like to put it on the bill, I'd love to have to do it.
Friendly?
This is the Thomasoni amendment, Senator Thomasoni amendment that Senator DeCryfe is putting on as an author's amendment, right?
This is on the education.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at an amendment here that I have in front of me that says A12.
Yes.
And
that's not what you were planning on?
I wasn't. I think so.
What's that?
Can I see a copy of that A12 amendment?
I don't think that was this author's amendment.
No, this my amendment is a delete all.
I don't believe we have that amendment.
And it includes 10 pages.
Oops.
Well, now you have another amendment that will be coming from Senator Thomasoni.
Unless, Madam Chair, it's included in the other one.
So the 812 amendment,
yes,
okay.
Is not the opposite. Where is this amendment?
We don't have it.
Apparently, the authors of these amendments.
Is there a different number?
They did not, but
we don't have a delete order.
Greg went to check.
Oh,
they keep stairs to see if there's
any
other amendments.
I got you.
So I'm just going to patiently wait. Senator Kreif, I guess we're at a loss as to where the amendment might be.
Who did you have draft on?
Joe Roletzka.
Who took off with it?
Oh, Joe Rowland took off.
Madam Chair, I believe Greg Marcus has the amendment.
He probably
just ran to get it.
He's going to look for it.
Okay.
Or if there's any amendments up there. Do you want to begin to discuss the...
I could begin explaining the amendment.
Yes, why don't you do
okay.
that?
Okay. This amendment makes two major policy changes to the original bill. The first change is to dedicate the state revenue from the bill after repayment of the school shift is complete to pay off bonding principal. The second change is to institute a purse structure agreed to by Canterbury Park, Running Aces, and the Equine Development Commission of Minnesota. Assuming Running Aces continues their 50-day meet and Canterbury Park increases their meet to 75 days, this will meet the industry's goals of placing harness racing and quarter horse racing in the top 10 nationally and thoroughbred racing in the top 15 nationally.
Those are the two provisions that are being changed in the new amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. So...
Madam Chair, is this in the education article?
Senator Wigger? I haven't seen the amendment, so I can't tell you where it is. I agree. That would be, is it, it's a delete all? So what's, or is it replacing?
Madam Chair, the amendment is a delete all. It's a delete everything. But those are the two major changes in the amendment.
So major changes actually deleting or changing Article 2 in terms of what happens with the revenue?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I don't understand.
Did he find it? Okay. they found an original and are making copies, so...
Thank you.
Is there any discussion in the interim until we get the piece of paper in front of us?
Well, Madam Chair?
Senator Wigger.
I had a question. You initially announced that there's no action today other than you're going to have it laid over for possible inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Have you decided when... you might show the omnibus bill, or
that's an option that's open to us, and it hasn't been determined yet. So
okay.
We've got to work with the other body and determine how we are. We've been trying to do a fair number of bills on their own, but there probably is going to very likely will be some that will be combined, and that there will be an omnibus bill of sort, and this is for possible inclusion. Nobody else has any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Stephen.
If we're going to talk about the delete all, then I guess, Senator DeCrieff, could you respond to, just since we're in the Education Committee, how much of the proceeds from the delete all will go towards paying off the school shift versus how much percent of, or what percentage of the income will go to the horse industry? Because I've kind of heard that the horse industry thinks this will be a big benefit to them. And if you could just, if we're wasting time, just talk about some of the differences.
Senator DeCrieff.
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, I wonder if I might maybe start by asking Eric Naumann to maybe start by explaining the school shift and how this this portion of the bill would, you know, how the school shift works and the two parts of the school shift that actually until a few weeks ago I didn't really understand that there was two parts to the school shift. So, Mr. Naumann, would you be willing to explain that portion to the committee?
Mr. Chair and members, again, without having the actual amendment in front of me, I'm going to just talk conceptually about the two shifts. So members are familiar that we have the state of Minnesota has instituted two separate shifts. The one that gets more conversation in this session certainly is the aid payment shift, and that is when the schedule of payments to districts have been adjusted. We consider an unshifted environment to be 90% of the current year's formulas added to 10% from the prior year. So you're always paying school districts on a percent of this year's formulas and then adding it to a lagging percent from the prior year. And so obviously when you move to something like a 70-30 shift or a 60-40 shift, you're paying school districts for the prior year and adding it to a smaller number for the current year. That's the aid payment shift, and it's certainly one that we're more conversant with in the committee because we haven't really talked that much about the property tax recognition shift. So if we move to the property tax recognition shift, this has to do with the schedule when school districts recognize property tax revenue. If you think about your own property tax payments and when you make those payments, you make one in the spring and you make one in the fall, and those fall in two different fiscal years. And in fiscal year 2011, based on action of the 2010 legislature, a property tax recognition shift was instituted. And what that did was require, I skipped over a piece, despite the fact that the payments land in two different fiscal years, prior to the shift, school districts were required to recognize the property tax revenue from the spring payment after July 1st. So that lined up those two payments in the same fiscal year. What the 2010 legislature did was change when that was recognized by school districts, thus property tax recognition shift. So the school districts then began to count the revenue from the property tax payments in the fiscal year in which they were paid. And in the first year that was instituted, school districts were actually getting three property tax payments that year. One from the prior spring, which was recognized after July 1st, the fall payment, and then the new one that would have been recognized after the subsequent July 1st, but under law was then required to be recognized in the year that it was paid. It's a mouthful, but essentially what happens is you change the date when school districts count that revenue, and it generates savings because the second step of it is to take a general education aid savings. So that, at the time that it was done, generated about $515 million. Because property taxes are on a growth trend, we have subsequently added another $40 or $50 million to that so that it's around $560-70 million of total property tax recognition shift. So, Madam Chair, I'll pause there. If there are questions, Senator DeCrieff mentioned this to me earlier, so he had given me fair warning that we wanted to talk about this, and I didn't want to go into too much detail, but if there's more questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Senator DeCrieff, you had indicated, no, we will have this before us shortly, but that in your amendment that it's proposing that the aid, the first revenue that would come in from the Racino would be to pay off these ships, both of them. It would be shift in payment schedule as well as property tax recognition. And then next, it would go to our bonded indebtedness?
Yes, Madam Chair. And our intention is to do this without changing current statute, which means, as most of us know, that if the state has a surplus, that money would go toward also paying off the school shifts. The one that most of us have talked about, that one would be paid off first, I believe, and then after that one's paid off, it would pay off the second one. And yes, my amendment would speak to once those school shifts are paid off, the proceeds would go to pay off bonding principal. And Madam Chair, if it would be your wishes, I could bring up someone from the Minnesota Lottery that might speak on the fiscal note and might be able to speak to monies that we might be looking to come in.
We're getting amendments now, Madam.
The amendments, okay, the amendments are here. So, Senator Bonhoff, did you have a question of Senator DeKreiff?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator DeKreiff, when you talk about bonding indebtedness, which bonding indebtedness are you referring to?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, on page 10 of this amendment, it speaks to the bonding.
Mr. Nelman.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say that was just the initial run on the copies. There'll be more coming.
Okay.
Well, and Madam Chair, I guess this is a question for Mr. Nauman. Mr. Nauman?
Senator Bonhoff.
Could you talk about the bonding? What, like, are you talking about our bonding bill? We have bonds every year that we issue. So what bonding indebtedness are we referring to?
Madam Chair, I gave senators copies. I don't have a copy of the amendment myself.
Sorry, you could. Well, Senator Bonhoff, I think we budgeted in the general fund amounts to pay our bonding. We kind of have a self-imposed limit of about 3% of our general fund, and so it would go to reducing that
that amount.
That's what I would understand it to mean, but maybe there's another interpretation. But it would pay down the money that we are spending to pay off our bonds.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Senators, I would agree with that. I'm just looking at the statutory references here. Yes, it would defease overall state debt.
Gotcha. Okay, thanks.
Senator Cruz, I think you had your hand up too, or did I?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. Have you all gotten copies of the, are you still waiting? You got them? Good. Okay.
Madam Chair, could I move my amendment at this point?
Yes, you may.
Okay.
This is A12-0829. Senator DeCruz moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1909. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, did somebody direct us to the...
Senator Tomasoni?
Somebody direct us to the provisions in the bill that we're talking about here?
I believe the one that we were just talking about is on page 10, and if we flip the page back, Racino Revenue on page 9, the Article 2 is what he was referring to as the first use of that revenue.
And Madam Chair, are you planning on taking any testimony on this bill, or?
Yes, we'd like it toward the revenue side of it that applies to education. But Senator Senator DeCraif did agree to accept your amendment, even if it isn't to that article.
Okay, there.
So,
was that on the bill now, too?
It isn't on the bill, but if you would like to put it on.
I would love to put it on.
I think it's been circulated.
It's an A-12 amendment.
It's A-12-0676.
Madam Chair, might I be permitted to speak to the bill before we get into any further amendments?
Yes. You want to wait with this amendment then?
Would that be okay?
Fine. Okay. Go ahead, Senator DeCraif.
Now that everyone has a copy of the amendment, I would like to speak to the bill. Members, today you are hearing the Racino bill. I know that we have all heard a lot about this bill in the past few weeks, so you really don't need a line-by-line description of this bill. Instead, let me talk for a few minutes about the reasons why I support this bill. It is important for Minnesota to have a healthy horse industry. There are dozens of jobs behind every horse. Fence builders, truckers, veterinarians, hay growers, farriers, saddle makers, and other small businesses make their living off Minnesota's horse industry. I don't want to see another Minnesota breeder decide to leave the state because we don't work hard enough to raise purses. Minnesota needs a plan to keep and grow our industry. Racinos are the model that is working around the country. Minnesota voters approved horse racing more than two decades ago. And state government approved casino gambling through compacts with Native American governments. Gambling is here to stay. In 14 states, racinos have been approved, and they have seen enormous growth in the racing industries. In places like Indiana and Pennsylvania, the economic impact of the horse industry has doubled and tripled, meaning billions of dollars to economic growth and tens of thousands of jobs. The numbers don't lie. If we want a healthier horse industry, we need to increase purses. Around the country, the model is simple. Give racetracks more gambling or more gaming options. It doesn't expand the number of gaming facilities in the state and certainly is more modest increase than the gaming machines added in existing casinos over the previous decade. This is a fairly modest proposal. As the fiscal note says, if 2,000 machines were added at both Canterbury Parks and Running Aces, we can raise approximately $130 million per year to repay the school shift. That's a really good use for that revenue. Racinos are legal in Minnesota. I hope you have read former Chief Justice Magnuson's opinion on this matter. He makes it clear that state lottery operated games are legal, and any court action would be handled swiftly and would not stop the orderly implementation of this bill. Even representatives from the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association agree there is no exclusivity to video lottery terminals in Minnesota. After all, tribal casino gaming is only legal because all of these games are legal and constitutional in Minnesota. More than 70% of our constituents want us to pass racinos. We have all seen the surveys. Democrats, independents, and Republicans, people who live close to casinos and people who live far away, people who don't gamble, and people who love to visit casinos. Minnesota supports racinos. Public support should not be the only reason we pass a bill around here. But when there are so many common sense reasons to do racinos, as legislators, we need to stop standing in the way of the public will. People want racinos, and they would be good for our billion-dollar horse industry. They would allow us to pay off the school shift faster, and we would bring competition to an industry that needs competition. For those reasons, I would like to see Racino pass this year.
And you have some testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have with me some representatives from the Minnesota Lottery, and they might explain some on the fiscal note.
To introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ed Van Petten. I'm a new executive director at the Minnesota Lottery. Drove into town on February 29, so I would ask legal counsel for the lottery and assistant director Dale McDonald is also here and will address the committee, I believe.
Yep, my name is Dale McDonald. I'm the assistant director and general counsel for the Minnesota State Lottery. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think there hasn't been a fiscal note prepared, to my knowledge, on this bill, but we have prepared one for similar Racino bills. Looking at the delete all amendment, is pretty similar, if not identical, to some other fiscal notes that we have prepared. And based on those fiscal notes, once the Racinos are up and running, which will take about a year and a half after enactment for permanent facilities to be up, there'll be temporary facilities initially. We estimate about $118 million dollars a year to be available to be used for the school fund shift.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions of Mr. McDonald? Would you like to add to that testimony?
Excuse me, ma'am.
Sir, would you like to add to the testimony, or was?
Well, I could tell the committee that we enacted similar legislation in Kansas in 2007, and the figures relied upon in this fiscal note are right on the money for what our experience was. So I believe that to be a viable number.
I have this one.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's 119.
Senator Nelson.
I said.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple numbers questions. Does it say in this delete all amendment somewhere, maybe you could direct me, Senator DeKreif?
Okay, go ahead.
Do we know how much is anticipated the revenue will be? I'd like to get a feel for what that anticipated revenue is, and then for the amount of the school shift that was enacted last year, how much and how long it would take to pay that back, and then the amount of school shift that was enacted by previous legislatures and how long it would take to pay that back.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I am sorry, but with this door opening up, it's really hard to hear.
Yes. Now, sir, I apologize. I didn't get your name written down. You're the director of the lottery.
The last name is two words, capital V-A-N, space, capital P-E-T-T-E-N. First name is Ed.
Ed Van
Petten.
Van Petten.
Old Dutch name.
Now, you just made a statement of the numbers that you projected. It was about 119 million or 108 that you projected?
Just under 118 million, ma'am.
118 million is what you were projecting would base that was consistent with what's happened other places, or just based on the costs and the fiscal note that you prepared here?
The fiscal note was prepared based on a number of performances in other states, which averaged about $108,000 per machine per year. And I would just tell the committee that our experience thus far in Kansas with electronic gaming would be consistent with that number.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator DeKreif, I believe I heard you say about $130 million. Is there a reason for that difference? Because I think that's what Senator Nelson is getting at, how much might be available each year.
And, Madam Chair, I think as we were looking through the fiscal note, I think one of the things that we were looking at is that on page 3 of the fiscal note, it talks about a total cost savings to the state, and there it says about $141,900,000. And now some of that money goes to environmental trust, some of that goes to general fund, and some goes to the new fund. So I know that there's some different numbers that are floating around. And so that's why I'm saying that if I might speak to one thing about this particular bill, what we're doing with this bill in paying off the school shift is we're paying off debt. This debt currently by statute would be paid off as we increase revenues. That could take many, many years. So what we're asking Racino to do is to supplement that payoff. So to say exactly how many years it might take to pay it back would be hard to actually estimate. Sure. Because if the economy really turned around and we had added revenue, it could be paid off potentially much, much faster. I believe right now, in fact, with this latest fiscal note, and maybe Mr. Nauman could speak to this, that there's an amount that's already been paid off of that school shift. And Mr. Nauman, would you be able to maybe do some quick math and just let us know how much is left? And if we relied solely on Racino and used the lottery numbers of approximately $118 million, how many years that might take?
Madam Chair, Senator DeKreif, I was just doing some quick math. I hadn't done that second part. But I can tell you $562, if you waived the fairy dust and had all the resources you needed to do it in fiscal 13, there's about $1.8 billion on the aid payment shift. Remember, members, we were talking about a $2 billion figure at the conclusion of last session. And the aid payment shift has already been bought back by about $318 million in the forecast, so it's a little bit lower now. So the remaining amount on the aid payment shift is about $1.8 million. And as I mentioned previously, $562 million is the property tax recognition shift, which in the language of the bill is the total value. Rather than speculating on an individual year, I'd rather cheat the question a little bit and say it's about $70 to $71 million for each percent that you do. And when fully implemented, the Racino looks like at about $116 to $120 million, give or take, on an annualized basis. So some simple math could get you there, but there's also the automatic buyback language in 16A, which, if the revenues exceed forecasts, would also contribute. I'd hesitate to put an exact number, but you get sort of the sense that once fully implemented, this would buy more than 1%, maybe a little bit, not quite a percent and a half each year.
Yes. Thank you.
Can I just follow up on one thing, then, Senator Nelson? When you talked about the lottery and the environmental trust fund, so because the lottery would be managing this, there's a portion of it that would count as the lottery's obligation to payment into the environmental trust fund as a part of the revenue from a Racino. On your fiscal note, it shows 8600 in. Well, it moves up 1600 to 6000 to 8600 into the environmental trust fund. What drives that?
Madam Chair, if I could respond, I'd try to respond to that. Basically, the money coming in from the Racino is first is taken off the top is the in lieu of sales tax, and that's the money that's available in this bill for the school shift. The money remaining after the in lieu of sales tax is then split for the operating cost and then for payments to the track for operating, and the money left over after that is considered lottery net proceeds, which is then split 60-40 between the trust fund and the general fund. So that's how the bottom line get to that.
So the education portion would come off first.
Correct.
Saying. Okay. Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, those were some of those figures that I was looking for, and I saw I had your calculator out, Mr. Nauman. I just want to give me a little bit of history here. In 2011, the school shift was how much, and then what was it prior? And kind of give me those numbers, please.
Madam Chair and members, the more recent number on the school shift was we were at a 73% current payment in fiscal year 2010. In fiscal year 2011, it went to 70%. The beginning of the current fiscal year started at a 60% payment, and members are familiar that in coincident with the February forecast, it went to 64.3, and that's where we stand now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Nauman, how much is left to be paid back from last year's shift then?
That's the 1.8.
When you say about last,
I believe that would be the amount that was in the Senate file that, or the House file that we acted on, and that's about $415 million. If If the question is, how much does it take to get to 70-30? If the question is, how much do you want to get back to 90-10, that's $1.8
billion. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just one follow-up, please.
I'm confused.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, and I was not sure what you meant, Mr. Van Patten, when you said the first amount of the Racino dollars is in lieu of sales tax dollars. I don't know exactly what that means or how much that is.
Oh, that was Mr. McDonald, actually.
The bill calls for that the lottery would pay in lieu of sales tax on the net revenue coming in from the Racino. And that, because currently on lottery tickets, we pay in lieu of sales tax on all lottery receipts. And that comes off the top before we do any other expenses or get down to the net profit. So in this bill, as in most of the other Racino bills, it takes the 25% off the first $150 million of revenue from each track. 25% is paid as in lieu of sales tax.
Thank you. That's what I was looking
Thank
for.
You. Thank you.
Senator Chamberlain.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Sure.
Senator Thomasoni.
So follow up on Senator Nelson's question. So what are we expecting then in the first year for purposes of this committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Thomasoni.
Mr. McDonald.
Yeah. In the... In FY14, because of the, it'll take at least 6 months for to get started, and then when they start, that'd be January of 2013. It's just going to be a temporary facility at both tracks. We only have a temporary facility for only half year. We estimate in FY13, that there would be about $20 million available for the school-aid shift. And in FY14, around $75 million. And then by FY15, they'd be full operational for a full year, and then it gets up to that $118 to $120 million figure.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members.
Mr. Nauman.
I'm still sifting through some of the language. Maybe it's worth noting the fiscal note that I'm looking at on an earlier version implies that 50% is available for education aides. Is that still correct? This may be another version. Yeah, maybe that's an older version.
I think the first dip is the education.
I apologize for that tangent.
Okay. Is there any other discussion? Is there any other testimony that you have, Senator Torres-Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't sure. I think Senator Nelson asked the total revenue, and then we went on to kind of just capture the actual revenue for education. Could you speak about the total revenue anticipated so that I can kind of see? You did a good job of saying 20 in the first year, 75 in year 14, 118 in year 15 for the education budget. Could you give me the total revenue in general? Not in terms of tax revenue, but the total revenue for the industry.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, when it's in fully operation in FY15, the way I read the fiscal note, the person from office who wrote the fiscal note is out of town, I'm familiar with it, but the total revenue from the total gross revenue, which is the revenue of money put into machines less prizes, would be $432 million.
Right. 432.
Thank you. 432. Once it's fully operational.
Thank you.
Per year?
Per year.
What was that number again?
432.
Senator Bono?
Madam Chair and Senator DeKreif, was there any thought about any other ways to, spend the additional revenue when they were paid off? Did you talk about early childhood? What made you decide? Well, I guess Senator Senjum, right? It's his bill, but.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, I think the reason that I'm interested in seeing it go to pay off bonding principal is because, for one thing, it's going to be a number of years from now. It's not something that we're going to see proceeds from in 2 years or 5 years, I don't think. It's going to be a number of years. And I believe that it should be specified what happens at that point so that at least there's a direction that future legislators can understand was looked at, that we should, and paying off debt should never be a bad thing to do. So that's really why I look to go in that direction.
And Mr. Senator DeKreif, I think it's also, you should regard this money as one-time money rather than on using it for general operations, because it isn't a certainty. I mean, none of our revenue is totally a certainty, but there can be ups and downs in this, and I think that if you use it for one-time things, and paying off debt is a, help, is a help to us as well. So I think that philosophy, I think, is a healthy one. I saw another hand. Who did it? Was?
Well, Madam Chair, I just had one more question.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just am wondering about order of precedence. So our current statute, which I think you mentioned, Senator DeKreif, is that any forecast that is above projection, that money pays back cash flow, budget reserves, and then goes to pay back the school shift. And I'm assuming that would still take place. This would kick in after in addition to money that is automatically put into paying back the school shift because of our current statute. So I just want to make sure this is in addition to, it's not supplanting.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, for that question. Yes, it is in addition to, but there's an order in that first it would go to pay off the school shift as, we normally talk about it, and then Eric Nauman helped explain another part of the school shift, that it would go to pay off that next. But it would be in addition to what current statute is. I would hope that our economy turns around and rebounds, and this does give us additional revenue. So this would be paid off in a lot shorter time than just relying on Racino.
Thank you.
Well, it would also, if you think about that practice, our current law that fills the reserves and then pays the shift, this would help speed up the repayment. And once that is paid off, the money that comes in our regular revenue forecast that would be surplus wouldn't be restricted to those. It would be available for use by the legislature in terms of other things that they want to be done. So, Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, on that point, it seems like on page 10, on line 10.1, it could be clarified that a little bit more if we would add the sequence for the aid payment shift buyback and then the property tax recognition shift. The way it reads right now, it's I suppose you could read it that way, but it seems like it would be clearer if you had deleted two and then inserted them on that the end of that line.
In other words, rather than it being and
then
So in other words, take it sequentially. Ms. Butler, do you see what's being suggested there? On page 10, line 1, look at the root of that. Well, let's see. It's actually, you got to start on page 9.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That the aim is to bring it back to the 90-10 with any remaining funds deposited in the fund in the budget reserve. Net aid reduction. I'm not sure I. Could you?
I think
the
council
could. Help explaining the item 2 here, because the first one is to increase the aid payment schedule for school aides. That's what we're really talking about in terms of the payback of the shift. That's happening on 9.30 to 33. So what is that first line referring to? Because then it'll go to the property tax recognition shift.
Madam Chair,
have you got a handle on that?
I understand the question. I think it is a relevant point. I went to the buyback statute because it's structured very similarly. And there we say that the Commissioner of Management and Budget must allocate money to the following accounts and purposes in priority order. And
is that 127A.441? What is
127A.441 relates to the property tax recognition shift.
Oh. 16A. But then it says the property tax recognition shift under section 123B.75.
Yes, Madam Chair, both of those statutes govern the shift.
The property tax recognition shift.
Mm-hmm. So the way I read this, Madam Chair and members, is paragraph 1, or clause 1, relates to the payment shift, the one that you're more familiar with. And then the paragraph 2 is the recognition shift. And I don't have any quibble with how those sections are, I mean, how the language in those individual clauses are drafted. I guess it is interesting to note that maybe someone who hasn't been part of this debate could read that and assume they get paid off concurrently. In other words, you'd be buying both shifts at the same time, and if that's the pleasure of the committee, we should probably clarify that. If it's not, then maybe you want to be a little bit more specific about the sequencing and adding something like in priority order.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nelson?
Actually, that's kind of what I had penciled in here. So on line 9.29, after the word dedicated, insert in priority order. If that accomplishes the task, I'd like to move that oral amendment.
Okay, Senator Nelson moves the oral amendment to on page 9.29, insert before the colon and in priority order, or
in priority order. Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I think this would be parallel language to current statute, so.
Yes. Not this amendment yet. Yeah. Any discussion on Senator Nelson's amendment? Not all in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion is adopted.
Chair, would you like to do the 812?
Okay, the 812 point, or dash 0676.
Madam Chair, would you
and
like
that's to? Been handed out, so I think you should have that.
I'd like me to engross it?
Senator Tomasoni. I'd
like me to engross it for you so it fits into the new amendment?
Certainly.
On line 1.2, it should say page 6, line 32. On line 1.4, it should say page 7, line 1. And on line 1.6, it should say page 10, line 9.
So, wait a minute. What you're going to have to start over. What are you talking about?
Okay, look on the amendment on page 1.2.
Yes.
All right. It should say page 6, line 32 before the comma insert.
Ah, okay. Page 6, line 32?
Yep. And then on page 1.4, or on line 1.4, it should say page 7, line 1.
Okay.
And then on line 1.6, it should say page 10, line 9.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Can I also recommend that on line 1.1, we change moves to amend the Senate file 1909 to A12-0829.
Okay. Madam Chair, the A12 amendment, what it does is does two things. It designates a track in Hibbing as a third racino, and it also reduces the number of racing days from 50 to 41 for a track north of Highway 2. And that's completely related to the weather.
Highway 2.
You don't have to use your passport to cross Highway 2, but north of there, the weather is a little bit different than down here, and so the number of racing days are probably less available than we are down here. We have some people here that can testify to this, but what this would be is a third racino. There is in place property that was owned by the IRRRB that has been optioned to a private entity. It's about a 40-some million-dollar project that will not only have a horse racing track, a quarter horse track, it would also have a car racing track and the potential for several other things in the wintertime, such as snowmobile racing. And the reason for the designation is because the business plan looked at building this track, and the cash flow was always in question, and it's similar to what the horse racing industry people are saying here today, that with some extra cash flow from the machines, the possibility of making this thing work is much better, and will guarantee that the track actually gets built. And I don't know if you would like to hear some testimony from some people that are from the range or not, but I have a couple of people here that might want to say something.
Senator DeKreif, you want to address the amendment first and see if you'd like to have any testimony to it?
Madam Chair, if Senator Tomasoni has some people that want to testify, I'm fine with that. I think I'm going to stay neutral on this.
Okay.
Do you want to hear some testimony? Or?
Yeah. If you want to, can we just have it brief, but a brief explanation?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, my witnesses can identify themselves, but also this will be not only a jobs issue, but this will generate more income for the education fund that's in this bill also. So, thank you.
Yes.
So, Senator Tomasoni, has there been any effort to make any projections as to what that might
I think they will have
mean?
Some, yes.
Okay. So, okay, thank you. Is it
Madam
Fito?
Chair. Madam Chair, my name is John Fito, members of the committee. I represent the Iron Range Racing Complex. It's a project that we've been working on for almost 19 years, and we're passing out a short synopsis of the project itself and addressing a number of the facts that that are specific to our effort. The investment group is a broad group representative of a broad cross-section of investors from all over northeastern Minnesota. The project itself will add approximately $17 million based on revenue projections to the state's revenue that hopefully will go forward to pay down the school aid shift. And we feel very comfortable that it will go a long distance toward doing a number of different things for northeastern Minnesota, in particular the city of Hibbing. This particular project is located, as Senator Tomasoni indicated, on a 620-acre site in the city of Hibbing. It's on Highway 169 between Hibbing and Chisholm. In fact, the city councils and the chambers of commerce of both Chisholm and Hibbing, a number of other organizations have endorsed this project over a number of efforts throughout the years. The project itself will be approximately $45 to $52 million. It will employ about 425 to 450 permanent employees, 200 construction jobs over a course of about 3 years. The other elements of the particular project, as the Senator Tomasoni had indicated, are, of course, the quarter horse racing. We've been working with quarter horse racing folks for about 6 years. The initial project itself was assisted in a great part by the folks at Canterbury Downs. They've been extremely helpful on our behalf. In fact, going so far as to help us with a study done by Innovations, indicating, in fact, that this particular project does work. It only, however, works on the basis of being a recipient of the Racino portion of the revenue base. The new property taxes alone for the community of Hibbing amounts to about $250,000. St. Louis County will receive $250,000. All of those particular elements indicate that this is a great public-private partnership, and it does create a destination attraction in northeastern Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rito. Sir, is it Mr. Allison?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Allison. I'm one of the principals in Iron Range Racing. I just wanted to, in trying to be brief, just highlight three main areas of John's detail he just gave you. $17 million to help fund the education shift, 425 to 450 new jobs for the Iron Range, an area that's in much need of diversity from the iron mining industry, and 350,000 visitors to Hibbing and Chisholm area, mining towns that are struggling to create a destination. And I think this Racino and our project certainly does that. Thank you, and we ask you to strongly consider our amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Allison. Are there questions that you have of the testifiers?
Madam Chair, one more point, if I may.
Mr. Pito.
One element that I did forget, the project itself has, as I said, been working with the community for a long period of time. The facility itself will include a 2.7-mile road course. That particular road course will be allowed to be used by the Hibbing Community College and its Peace Officers Training Program, a program that right now is using the airport tarmac as a training facility. So this would be a dramatic upgrade and again, one more element toward education.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, could I get some clarification on what this amendment number is?
Senator DeCrife, it is the A12-0676. Both of these amendments, yours and this one, were done by the revisor. They didn't come through our Senate council, and that's why it's a less typical numbering system than we're used to.
So it's the last four digits, Madam Chair, last three digits that are actually the difference between the two?
Yes, there's 0676 versus 0829.
Thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome. Senator Bonhoff, did you?
No.
Okay. Well, Senator Tomasoni, Senator Nino?
Hey, Madam Chair. Senator Tomasoni, I've had the privilege, if you will, of seeing this issue throughout the years. And one of the strongest selling points over the years is that this isn't an expansion of gambling. It's already happening. This amendment, and unless I'm misunderstanding, it would be a considerable expansion of gambling. Does that undermine the overall bill?
Madam Chair, if this is an expansion of gambling, then Racino's an expansion of gambling also. Because any way you're looking at it, you're adding machines. But I don't think it's an, I don't consider it an expansion of gambling from the standpoint that this type of gambling is being done in the state of Minnesota. So it all depends, I guess, on what your definition is. But I know that slot machines are being added all the time to various casinos. So if increasing the number of slot machines is not considered to be an expansion of gambling, then this is not either.
Senator Bono.
Well, Madam Chair, and I'm glad Senator Nenow said that, because I've just been a little uncomfortable. If you look at the number of people in this room, it's because there are so many people who are on one side or the other of this issue and have been working for years, and there's this, you know, dance going, you know, who's for it, who's against it, and this comes before, and I haven't heard both sides on, I mean, I've heard a lot both sides on the other issue that we're hearing today. I just haven't really had the time to understand, you know, what kind of implications would this have on other sectors up by where you live? How does the city, the various cities involved feel about it? So, you know, I have a cabin in Orr. How does it impact various things up there? How will it impact the young people? What's the access? It's new, so I'm kind of grappling with it.
Well, there's, you know, the interesting, intriguing part of it that you have both a racetrack and then looking at snowmobile racing. Those are more competitive. Do you see any betting or gambling in relation to those? We do have pari-mutuel betting by constitutional amendment that allowed for other racetracks, and that would obviously apply to the horse racing that you would have there. How would that affect the, because you're adding a couple of venues that we don't have as much of in the state, so it's got some new approaches in terms of attracting people with different interests.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Fino. Do the chambers, or how do the people, what sense do you have of what the people up there want?
That's what I want.
The project itself has been endorsed by the Hibbing Chamber of Commerce, the Chisholm Chamber of Commerce, a number of other chambers of commerce across the Iron Range. There was a petition signed by almost 6,000 people when the project first began. So, in essence, this is a project that really has a broad cross-section of support. It's a project, however, that's missing the one piece to make it happen, and that is the Racino portion. We sat with the folks from the Quarter Horse Racing Group as kind of an element also that is not as well served as they might be if, in fact, this facility took place. So we're trying to make all of these pieces fit together. This has been studied. This has been worked over. This has been there's been three different studies. The University of Minnesota Duluth has done two different studies on this particular project. The upside has been extremely positive. We can certainly submit those particular studies for part of the testimony if the chair and the committee would so choose. I brought a study with me. The fact that this project has been around for a long, long time. We've testified here, in fact, at the legislature a number of times over the years. And so it's been a project that obviously has been somewhat dwarfed, if you will, by the elements, the other two elements of the Racino, which, of course, are Canterbury Downs and Running Aces. We are in northeastern Minnesota, so we don't quite get the profile, but we see ourselves as a full partner. The fact that we're bringing $17 million worth of new revenue to the state of Minnesota and hopefully to the school aids restoration, to me, is a very substantial element that could help as well as promote the 400-plus jobs in northeastern Minnesota.
And Madam Sir? Chair, I think to your question, I there's no intent of betting on the car races or on the snowmobile races, so it's just the horses that they're planning on betting on.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the reason for the amendment, Senator Bonoff, is simply because it guarantees that they'll get the license and the location is then guaranteed, so that the principals who want to build the track and put about $44 million of their own money into it know that they'll be able to cash flow it by using the revenue from the Racino.
Senator Thompson?
Madam Chair, and I would just like to encourage members to vote against the amendment, and I want to echo what Senator Nino pointed out. Obviously, I've spent a lot of time talking with the Racino opponents and proponents, and he's exactly right. One of the major selling points is this isn't an expansion of gambling. It's going to stop with the two places. I don't blame Senator Tomasoni. He wants something for his folks. There's no rationale then, if we put one there, to not put one in Winona and Worthington and Brainerd and East Grand Forks and Moorhead. And that. And I think that, that this perfectly supports the opposition of this, that it's not going to stop there. And there's no logical stopping point, especially when one of the points of argument is that we are trying to make it a free market thing. We're trying to eliminate monopolies. And then why would we stop it anywhere, right? If two are good, seven are better. And so I think that, that I would certainly encourage a vote against the amendment.
Well, Senator Thompson, if anybody does market research, I would think that it wouldn't take too long to figure out how much the market would bear in terms of number of tracks. And people wouldn't necessarily be able to make that, be willing to make that private investment if there wasn't the potential of it having a modicum of success. So I think that that kind of argues against the, that everybody will want to do this.
You're right, Madam Chair. That's why there's only two tracks in the state now.
Well, Senator Tomasoni, if there's no further discussion, renews his motion on the A-12 amendment, 0676. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The chair is
in doubt. It passed.
I think I'm going to have to ask for division. All in favor? Raise your right hand. Opposed?
Thought you were neutral.
I'm neutral.
What's that? There being four and nine against, the motion does not prevail. All right, is there Senator Stump?
Thank you.
Thank you, folks.
Madam Chair, Senator DeCray, a question about the what happens after the school age shift and the property tax recognition shift is paid off. You know, we set up this special fund for this. And the money goes into that special fund, and it's just used for education. Have you given any thought to the fact that maybe rather than go after and pay off bonds, state general fund bonds, that it would be better to have that money go into the education trust fund and have that money... That's a way of creating one-time money into ongoing money. And it would be a way to allow the education system in the state to benefit in a much longer term than just the buyback of the shift. And that's more of a statement than...
Yeah, yeah. Senator Cruz, were you wanting to respond to that?
I was, Madam Chair, but I changed my mind.
Okay. Okay, if there's no further discussion, or is there any... Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair, I motion to table the bill.
I am laying it on the table for possible consideration to inclusion in an omnibus bill.
I believe that a motion to table is a higher motion than
right.
a motion to lay it over.
Madam Chair, I request a roll call on that.
I am laying it on the table.
Madam Chair,
and
I believe
the chair has that power to do, and I announced intent, and that's what I'm doing. So the bill is laid on the table. So let's go on to the next item. Okay. Is Senator Senator?
We need to.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I call that into question. I need to understand the process. I would like to have a vote on that motion to table that bill. It is my understanding, I have been reading the manual right now, it is my understanding that we have the right to call for a table, for tabling a bill, and that is a higher motion than your motion, and we're requesting a vote on that motion.
I did not make a motion. I laid it on the table, and the chair has the power to do that, I believe.
Madam Chair, I would like to ask for a clarification on that. If we request, if a member of the committee requests a vote to table, I would like to know if that is a higher motion. I understand that it is a higher motion, and we are requesting a vote on it.
Okay, I think the interpretation is because I announced that before we started that this the other motion is out of order.
But Madam Chair, I'm a little confused.
There is also a motion, there's also, you know, it will there at some point there can be a motion to take it off the table. But that is on the table, and we are intend to move on to the rest of the agenda for today. We've heard the bill, we've had opportunity to offer amendments, and that's where we're going to leave it for now.
Madam Chair, I apologize, but just a quick point of clarification. If the bill was laid on the table before we started discussion, what were we discussing? And then secondly, between the two motions, am I correct in assuming that the motion to lay it on the table is the higher of the two motions than to lay it over?
I didn't make, I said that I would be laying it on the table.
Madam Chair, I understand. I'm simply asking for the difference between a motion to lay it on the table and a motion to lay it over, which, if I'm correct, was your motion in the beginning.
It ends on the table, which is further away than any motion to pass it and advance it the other way. So it's essentially a moot point. So let's move on. Is Senator Senjum here to present his bill, or is someone doing that in his place? Thank you, Senator Kreif. Folks. What's happening to Senator Nelson? Senator Harris? Who's coming?
Okay, here's what I'm trying to get. There's a difference between laying it on the table. Sorry. She motions to lay it over. To lay it on the table. And it's a non-debatable motion.
Senator Senjum? Senator Burson. Senate File 2515.
It doesn't matter. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 215, and I'm going to be really, really brief about this because it gets into some finance discussions, which if I try to put together in my own words, I'm going to cobble them up. But I'm going to say first-class city and debt limits, and then I'm going to refer this discussion to whoever wants to start. And this would be Mr. Larry Smith. He's the finance director for the Rochester Public School System.
Thank you very much. Mr. Schmidt?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Rochester Public Schools currently serves a student population of about 16,400 students. The city of Rochester is growing, and as such, the school population is growing as well. With certification of the census from 2010, Rochester is now a city of the first class according to Minnesota Statutes 410.01. The school district has established a long history of facility planning through the use of periodic community facility task force committees to address future needs, and the use of a rolling 10-year plan to address major maintenance, health and safety, and accessibility issues in its facilities. In order to meet facility needs for students and education over the last 20 years, Rochester Public Schools has issued general obligation bonds to construct the third high school, to replace two older elementary schools with one new school, to construct an additional elementary school for expanding enrollment, and to complete major maintenance projects on the other two existing high schools and one existing middle school. Rochester Public Schools currently has just over $66 million in outstanding general obligation debt. The district has sound financial management policies in place and currently holds a AA1 underlying bond rating with Moody's and a AA+ underlying bond rating with Standard & Poor's. Rochester is one of five school districts in the state of Minnesota to carry this bond rating or higher. In our continuing efforts to be fiscally responsible to the taxpayers of the community, the school district has taken action to refund several of those bond issues, replacing them with new debt carrying lower interest rates, thereby reducing the property tax burden on the local taxpayers. The limit on the municipality debt is established under Minnesota Statute 475.53. Generally, Subdivision 4 places the debt limit at 15% of the net market value in the community. With the city of the first class designation, we now fall under Subdivision 5, which places that limit at 0.7% of market value rather than 15% of the market value, which means that now with the first class designation, Rochester Public Schools debt limit is now approximately $75 million, of which we've utilized $66 million. With the existing debt being repaid over about 17 years, this only leaves about $9 million under that current cap with which to meet near-term facility needs. Our middle school enrollment is nearing capacity. We have space needs for area learning center programs as well as early childhood special education programs. Just because we are now a city of the first class, we're being placed under a more restrictive limit. There were other districts previously that fell under this subdivision, which, to my understanding, have also received exemption from this subdivision. So Rochester would be, I believe, the only district that would be subject to this limit if it's not exempted.
So, Senator Sinjam, your bill would actually repeal that limit for all school districts?
Madam Chair, that's correct, albeit all those districts, my understanding, would be those that are cities of the first class. So one would have to think a little bit about which city might be the next one along the way that might be affected by this.
Now, Senator Nelson was attempting to kind of solve this in a different way with the bill that we heard. We probably need some clarification. Mr. Nauman, would you want to clarify the difference between these two approaches?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Senator Nelson's approach didn't actually deal with Rochester, the Rochester School District.
It did not?
It did not. That bill dealt with the language that said partially contained. So there was a smaller district, its name now escapes me, which district we were interested in at the time. So we eliminated the language that said partially, so then it applied just to the districts that had a concurrent that were cities of the first class. And that amendment was approved. I'll offer, Madam Chair, while you've recognized me, that I have had a conversation with the Department of Education, and none of us can recall exactly why this statute is in place. It seems to be a fairly old statute, and I don't believe Dr. Melcher feels that anything negative would occur if this bill were to become law.
Well, it would seem you are still having to pass referendum to sell bonds for these projects, and what kind of rating for your own fiscal responsibility is something you watch to in order to get the best advantage. So, you know, what does this, of what aid, you're saying that there's question as to why it would be necessary and...
Well, Madam Chair, the question I think is that the testimony spoke to that there's a lower limit if you happen to be a district that has part of your land occupied by a part of your school district physical boundary is part of a is concurrent with a boundary of the city of the first class. And so Senator Nelson's striking of partially eliminated that problem. But then the larger question becomes, since we have not withstood this statute for two of the other cities of the first class when they've had issues with this, I think it becomes a relevant question, do we even need the statute? And I think the information that I've received from the department, I personally am satisfied that I don't think that anything deleterious would occur if you were to choose to go this route.
Well, it's kind of nice to see a bill. I've often said that we should have a session every now and then that only allows bills that are repealers. And this is kind of nice to see a bill that just is a repealer. So are there questions that you have of witnesses or Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My understanding was that the amendment we did, I think it was Friday even, or Thursday, actually took care of Rochester and the small towns around Rochester. However, this bill actually does what we talked about in committee, which is, you know, let's just get rid of this needless piece of law here, these four or five lines. And I will just remind the committee that this is the first time in 40 years that there has been a new city of the first class. We hope that many more of our cities will be growing as well. But I don't know that it's going to be a long time, perhaps, before this piece of legislation would come into play again. And as we've seen, every time it does, there is an exemption. So I am asking the committee for a favorable vote in striking this language that let's make our statutes a little smaller. Mm-hmm.
Is there any further discussion? I see
Madam Chair, Senate Research or Council on Research just mentioned that it was Stuartville, I think.
Stuartville?
Madam Chair, Superintendent Dr. Michael Munoz is with us, and he drove 100 miles, and if he could offer some brief comments, that would be, I think, welcome.
Welcome, Superintendent.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Mr. Smith provided a lot of...
Just say your name for the record,
okay,
so we get it on the
table. Excuse me. Michael Munoz, Superintendent, Rochester Public Schools.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Smith, our CFO, provided a lot of good background information. The only thing I would add is I've had the fortunate to work with our city chamber and sit on their Workforce 2020 initiative, and I'm constantly hearing that they're predicting Rochester to, in the next 10 years, 10,000 jobs. With those 10,000 jobs, we anticipate families will be moving to Rochester, and we know some of those are going to have children. And as we look down into the future for our district, we anticipate we're going to have to be doing some buildings. And with the way it's written now, with our limits, it would be very difficult for us to meet the needs of those new families. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Is there any further discussion? If not, I presume Senator Nelson would probably like to make this motion.
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 2515 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Is there any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the Senate floor. Senate File 2515 is passed. Senator Nelson, you might as well stay there. Your bill is next.
Yes. I just need my folder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
And committee. Thank you for allowing me to present Senate File 2346. This is a bill about adult...
I believe we're working from the House file now. House file 2291 is the,
okay,
the number we have here.
We'll take the House file, 2291. Members and Chair Olson, this bill is an adult basic education bill. As we know in our committee, we've often talked about the importance of literacy. And adult basic education's goal is to help adults be provided with educational opportunities so they can acquire and improve their literacy skills that are necessary so that they can participate effectively as productive workers, family members, and citizens. And occasionally, there are items that happen beyond the control of adult basic education that would impede their services, or there would be a service disruption. We would call those things, in the insurance world, sometimes we call those things acts of God, or things that are beyond their control. And this bill actually just provides some safe harbor for when those type of things happen. And what I'd like to do today is introduce the testifiers and have them explain just a little bit of the background about how adult basic education funding is different than education funding and why this particular bill is necessary for adult basic education. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Tom Citrin Heisem.
Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Tom Citrin Heisem, representing Literacy Action Network, which is the statewide advocacy group for adult basic education learners. I just very briefly would like to explain the formula, very briefly, because that really affects why this legislation is so badly needed. Under the adult basic education funding formula, there are four components. There are three small components having to do with aid based on ELL students, the number of adults 25 and over that don't have high school diplomas, and population aid. The main funding, though, close to 90%, is based on learner contact hours. And unlike K-12 funding, where you're guaranteed a certain amount of money per learner, we are forward funded based on the number of learner contact hours the previous year. So when we have a I want to mention that when we have a serious disruption of some sort, that decreases our hours greatly in a given site or in a given consortium in 1 year, that can really affect the service availability that is available the next year. I want to just, in terms of background, also note that adult basic ed is a very highly accountable system. We were one of only three states this last year that received a WIA incentive grant from the federal government, and that's based in part on our success in meeting the national reporting system standards, which are basically the outcomes for our adult learners. So we have a very strong, accountable system, and our concern is keeping that system equally accessible throughout the state. So if there is a case of a flood, a tornado, or some other major disaster, and a program goes way down in hours in a given year, there are also limits in the formula. They can't grow the next year to make that up. They can only grow a very small percentage. So when the flood recedes and the buildings are once again usable and so on, the people are going to come back, but there will not be the adequate funding without this bill to allow them to continue. We've had several cases over the past 10 or 15 years where this kind of situation has happened, and adult basic education and community ed directors went to our state office and said, is there some way you can make some adjustment to hold us harmless? And they were told that although they would very much like to do that, there was simply no way under the current statute as it is that they could do that. So what this would do would be to provide a one-time discretionary hold harmless if hours fell 10% in a consortia or 15% in an individual program. It would require no new funding, no new allocation. It would come out of the existing adult basic education funding. And I think with that, I'd like to turn it over to Julie Nigun, who is the ABEE coordinator supervisor from Rochester.
Madam Chairman.
Madam Vice.
My name is Julie Nigun. I'm the
Ms. Higgins, welcome.
Thank you. I'm the manager of adult and family literacy programming for the Rochester Public Schools, which is Rochester's ABE program. So it must be Rochester Day here in this committee.
It's always Rochester Day.
It's always Rochester Day, of course. We are the center of the universe, or at least the center of our own universe. I'm here not because I expect to benefit from this bill or from this amendment. I'm here because I understand how this can happen and what, as an ABDE manager, I feel like I need to do to help my fellow program managers throughout the state. I've been a manager now for over 20 years, and during that time, I've actually learned something. And a few things, actually, which might surprise you. But one of the things that I have learned, one of the most important lessons I have learned, is that our programming for adults must be convenient, it must be appropriate, and it must have excellent outcomes. Because our students choose to come to us, our students are busy adults, most of whom are parents already, working and still knowing that they need to continue their education. They're dedicated to education, and they make time in their busy lives to come to school. So our school curriculum must constantly change to be relevant, to help them achieve their goals as quickly as possible, and to be scheduled in a way and to have a calendar that meets their very busy lives. If we don't, they don't come. So when they do come, it's really important that those services are there. We, as stated before, our programming is funding is not based on per pupil funding, as is K-12. It is based on student hours from the previous year. That is an important difference between us and K-12. That being said, even though I don't ever expect and hope I never have to be helped by my fellow ABE programs, I can give you a concrete example of what can happen to a program when there is a disruption. This happened to us in 2002. It was brief, but because the district recognized our unique funding situation, it was as brief as possible. We were in a situation where the school district very generously remodeled one of its facilities for our use. We had not had our own building previously. We'd been renting space throughout the city. We had carefully planned for over a year during the remodel so that we would be ready to move in. The building would be ready to go in mid-August, which is when we take our break before the after Labor Day opening. Of course, any of you who have done any remodeling in your home, in your business, in your area of life, know that things don't exactly go according to plan, no matter how well you plan. And so instead of our building being ready for us to start the move in mid-August, it was not going to be ready until October. Again, thanks to the school district administration recognizing the unique funding situation of adult basic education programs and what would happen to us if we would just simply, the easiest thing would be to just shut us down for a couple of months and open up in the new building. But thanks to our landlords who gave us extra time and our school district who recognized the impact going forward during the current year on our students and going forward on our program funds, everyone banded together to make this happen in mid-October over the MEA break. And so instead of losing 5 days of programming, we managed to make this move in 3 days. And it was huge, to the point where the school district pulled its custodians off other buildings. The truckers for the district all banded together. Even the community ed director, Dr. Jackie Silver, helped me personally clean the computer lab so that we could be open and ready on Monday morning and not lose revenue and give students an opportunity to go to school. Students can't wait. Adult learners really can't wait. And we couldn't afford to be closed much longer than that. So I urge you, and I first of all, I want to thank Senator Nelson for sponsoring this. I want to thank you for listening to us and understanding that we are different and we're trying to meet the needs of a community of adult learners. And I want to thank my fellow ABE managers in promoting something to help each other. So thank you for helping us help each other.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Higgins, for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. And just a couple things that you might need to know about the bill.
The commissioner may adjust. There's nothing automatic about this. It just gives the commissioner the flexibility to hold harmless in these specific cases of service disruption. So it's permissive as far as the commissioner's concerned. I do want to thank this committee. It wasn't that long ago that we passed the legislation that took another step of accountability for the adult basic education programs. And remember, they are now also collecting data on their graduates and how many have left assistance roles. So I also want to thank Senator Harrington, Senator Stump, and Senator Olson for their support on this bill.
Senator Stump?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if Senator Nelson would be amenable to a friendly amendment. On line 1.11, 1.11, if we just put a period after party and then deleted the remaining portion of that sentence.
What is the definition of party? Did somebody have a raucous party and tore up the place and you couldn't meet, or is it?
I'd like to hear Senator Stump's.
What are you doing to this bill?
I withdraw that one, but I do have a legitimate question, and that is, I think someone mentioned that this is a one-time adjustment.
Yes, I believe it is.
Does it say someplace where it is a one-time adjustment?
Let me look at the language here, Senator Stump.
I couldn't find it, but
can you answer that? Madam Chair, to that point.
Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, and Senator Nelson, it was mentioned that it was one time, but I read the bill, too, and it doesn't say one time.
Madam Chair, maybe that's what happens when we get bills from the House. My understanding was that there was a one-time piece in there as well.
But, Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I don't even know that you'd want it to be one time. If you have two tornadoes, you have two tornadoes. What can you do?
Yes. Madam Chair and committee, I am fine with the bill. And I must say, as a former House member, I don't want to totally denigrate the House, but I was just joking there. I guess the will of the committee is okay in my regards as far as one time or whether it would be ongoing. I think the point is we want to make sure that there's no room for abuse. I don't think that there would be. ABE is a highly ranked program, very successful in all regards as far as its data collection and its outcomes. So I don't feel compelled to reinsert the fact that it's one time unless that's something the committee feels is necessary.
Well, Senator Stump, what was it, were you getting at something?
No, Madam Chair, I actually just picked up on the explanation, and then as I read the bill, it didn't really say one time any place, so I was just wondering.
But even in terms of the ending of the sentence there, did you have
It was purely a I've been sitting too long today.
I can relate to that. Okay. So it would seem strange that, you know, once time in your history, why would we change the policy if it's things that are beyond their control?
Exactly.
That I think if we find that something strange happens because of this, there's always got to be work for the next legislature.
Exactly. So, Madam Chair, could I move Senate or House File 2291 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor?
Okay. Is there any further discussion on that? Was there anybody else that wanted to testify? I think you've had good testimony, and maybe you don't need any more. I think we understand it. And I will ask for the question. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion, the bill passes, and it is on its way to the Senate File 2291 is passed.
House file.
And go, excuse me, House File 2291 is passed and will go on to the Senate floor.
Thank
I've been
you,
sitting too long and doing something else too long, too, I think. So, we have one more bill, and Senator Harrington, Senate File 2460.
Madam Chair?
You've been sitting patiently waiting for this, and welcome, Senator Harrington.
I've been running the stairs, actually, patiently between the two committees, but I've been trying to sit patiently. I appreciate your deference in letting me get in at the last minute, and I also want to thank Senator Wolf, who is the co-sponsor of this bill. Okay. This is Senate File Number 2460. Back when the Minnesota applied for the Race to the Top grant, they had to identify a list of persistently lower-achieving schools consisting of those who scored in the bottom 5% in test scores and those who, with an on-time four-year graduation rate, less than 60%. When they created that list, they exempted area learning centers and certain contract alternatives from that category. They did that because they recognized that those schools had, as part of their design, the invitation and the willingness to take students who were of an at-risk nature, that oftentimes were overage and had under credits. Simply, that was the mission of those two types of schools. There were charter schools in Minnesota that had specifically stated in their mission that they were also targeting those students, in particular those students who had dropped out, and or those students who were at risk of dropping out. This set of schools, unfortunately, did not get exempted in the rules, and they were then included on that list of persistently low-achieving schools. The result of that was that despite the fact that they were doing exactly what their mission said they were supposed to do, which is to work with overage and undercredited students, because of their categorization on that list, they were forced to dismiss principals, fire most of the staff, and in some cases close their school. The inconsistency is fairly baffling to me in that we have schools who are by design trying to attract and trying to address the dropout rate and try and address the achievement gap by working with that particular population and then to penalize them for the fact that they are deliberately working with this one of the toughest populations to serve, and then instructing them to get rid of the people that are oftentimes willing to work in this population didn't make any sense to me. And so when this bill came to me from the School for Recording Arts, I was quite happy to try and pull this bill together. With me today is Ms. Paula Anderson, and I'm going to let her introduce the other testifiers, and because of the lateness of the day, I'm going to ask her to be as succinct as possible and to keep the other testifiers also on a tight timeline also.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Paula Anderson. I'm the Education Director and English Teacher at High School for Recording Arts. And this is not just a High School for Recording Arts bill. We're really speaking on behalf of the handful of charter schools in the state that are serving overage, at-risk, undercredited students. It was actually mathematically impossible for us to achieve a 60% four-year graduation rate at the time when the PLAS list was created, the persistently lowest achieving list. And we asked for a waiver, and we did ultimately receive it because the U.S. Department of Education ultimately came out with some guidelines saying that states did have the flexibility to grant these kind of exemptions and waivers. So High School for Recording Arts did get a waiver. We were only cited on the list for our graduation rate being under 60%. As you can see, this is an issue of equity. We serve the same student population as is served by area learning centers and contract alternatives. And right now I'm going to introduce Bill Zimowitz and Allie Werner from Jennings Community Learning Center. Thank you, and thank you, Senators.
Hi, my name is Allison Werner. I'm a 10th grader at Jennings Community Learning Center.
Welcome. Ms. Werner and
Okay. Ed Jennings, I planned a school trip to Florida to study marine biology. And honestly, if it wasn't for my teacher, Sarah, I probably wouldn't be on track to graduate. Before I went to Jennings, I was going to drop out. And now that I think back about it, that would have been the dumbest decision of my life. I'm so glad I went to Jennings. A few years ago, I didn't really care about school or anything, really. I definitely didn't give teachers any type of respect. I could have cared less about getting sent home or suspended because that meant I didn't have to go to school. And a lot of the time, I would get kicked out of the class just to go home. Now I realize it was stupid because obviously I wasn't learning anything from sitting in class for 5 minutes, then getting kicked out. And now I don't even remember the last time I got in trouble. I actually like school now and the teachers there. I've had one of the best experiences of my life because of the school. The Florida trip honestly made me grow up a lot because I knew if I got in trouble in the middle of planning the trip, it would mess everything up for me. The Florida trip made me think about what I would like to do in the future with my career. I've always been interested in marine biology, but before the trip, I thought it would be something that just be cool to do, but never really do. Now I think this is something I could actually do with my life and my career, and it is all because of the school. Thank you for taking your time out of your day and listening to me.
Thank you, Alton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for listening to us. My name is Bill Zinmos. I'm the director of Jennings Community Learning Center. We're located in St. Paul on University Avenue near 280. And Allie came to us last year as a ninth grader. And I asked for her permission to speak. She had a fairly large disciplinary record, and you wouldn't know that today. And our goal is to engage kids, and they're highly, you know, a lot of them, all our kids are highly at risk. Was Jennings started to serve at-risk populations per se? Perhaps not. But that's who is attracted to our school. That's the students we serve. They are, years behind, credits behind. Last night at 9:30 at night, a student called my cell phone. She was out on the street. I said, you need to get a hold of the police. I asked her where she was. She wouldn't tell me because she knew I'd have the police to come and help her. But this is no offense, Senator Harrington, but she did not trust the police.
Hard to believe that, I know. So.
but she was okay, you know, and she's okay today, and we did manage. But this is the kind of clientele we have. This student has not had any success in school, and we just am starting to get to know her. I support this bill. Thank you all for considering it. It's important because I have come from the Area Learning Center. I was director of South St. Paul. Area Learning Center for 14 years, from 1990 to 2004. And now I'm in the charter world, and I'm into innovation and all those kinds of things, but I'm into engaging students like Allie, like others. And invite anybody to stop into any of our schools, and there's a lot of exciting things happening, but we have to be realistic with the expectations and the population who we work with.
Ms. Lawrence, how would you describe the difference, since you've worked in an area learning center and now in a charter school that's functioning with similar, would you say a similar population?
Actually, our school is, perhaps it's a location, but our school, our kids, maybe it's the time, maybe it's the era we live in. I believe our students are more at risk than I had at South St. Paul.
I have more homeless. At the area learning center.
Excuse me?
At the area learning center. You said you worked in an area learning center, and now you're at a charter school.
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes.
But serving similar, but you're saying more challenging students that you're serving in the area learning or in the charter school that you're working in now than you did in the area learning center.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is and that's my situation. I don't know if that translates to everybody, but I'm seeing more homelessness, incarceration. Serious issues.
How do you see the difference in terms of your ability to function to serve people like this between an area learning center and a charter school? Can you give a little contrast there?
Sure. Madam Chair, one thing, the reason I decided to actually I started another charter school in West St. Paul, but what I wanted was autonomy, and that's what people who start charter school, we want accountability, but we also want the autonomy that you're not kind of district is kind of, you know, says we have to do it a certain way. I was attracted to the idea about being innovative. The experience, I had great experiences at South St. Paul. They were some of the highlights of my career, particularly in 2002 and 2001, 2 and 3, where at that time our school was the only alternative school that got the comprehensive school reform grant. They don't have it anymore. But we did so many wonderful things engaging kids. That's why I went to the charter world, because I knew the only place that we could create our own reality and help more kids and engage kids in learning, and that's our main thing is to get kids to want to learn. Allie didn't want to learn. She wanted to drop out when she turned 16, and she planned this trip. You know, I'm taking some kids to D.C. in May, but she planned this whole Florida trip, raised money in various ways. She never had any of those experiences before. Next year, she's trying. She's got a proposal in to study marine biology in Hawaii. I guess this time dolphins and whales. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not involved with those trips, or her advisor is. And so I see the flexibility at a charter school I embrace. And I did have great times at Area Learning Center, but it's a similar population.
But a different structure.
Different structure in the question of autonomy and board structure and things like that.
Okay.
Madam Chair, may I answer the same question?
Yes.
I had 10 years with the St. Paul Area Learning Center programs, and now 9 years in a charter school.
Anderson?
Yes, Paula Anderson.
Yes.
And I actually saw students that were kicked out or dropped out of the ALC program that I worked at down the street succeeding at High School for Recording Arts. That's one of the reasons that I wanted to make the change to working in a charter school. I see kids more engaged because we can use more innovative practices. We can make decisions, for example, having evening hours and studio time in the evening, because that's prime crime time for teens and it keeps kids off the streets. I'm seeing more homelessness, much higher rates of incarceration, a much more at-risk population, many more crises than we had at the ALC. So I believe that we are serving a very much more at-risk population at High School for Recording Arts, and I feel like we're doing a very good job, and our staff is trying very, very hard. A big difference for me is how stressful it is to deal with No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, School Improvement Grant, the waiver, and now, you know, the rewrite of No Child Left Behind. So I really feel like until we solve this problem of how to treat charters whose specific mission is to serve at-risk students, we're going to run into this problem again and again. So the time to fix this is now. Let's be proactive.
Senator Stubb.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wouldn't the question best be put to the department as to why you weren't picked up in the beginning to be part of that race to the top?
Yeah, my next thought here is, you know, hearing your contrast and your experience of what the language in the bill does, because you're asking to be treated like an area learning center.
Yes.
So I think we need a little understanding of how are you treated that's different, and what, or is an area learning center treated in relation to this kind of data?
Area learning centers and contract alternatives were largely exempted from being on the persistently lowest achieving list because it is understood that they have an at-risk population. That is a good decision. We just asked to be part of that group and part of that decision.
Okay. So it's a fairly simple kind of thing that's how they are not on that persistently low achieving if and you want to be included, if you've got 60% now are eligible to participate in the graduation incentive program. Let's get a review of that. Would you like to?
Yes.
Okay. So from 124D68, who can help us here?
Madam Chair, I have it.
I think I was. I think whenever we put that in, I was a co-author on that bill. But don't ask me to remember all the details. I've been around here too long.
Madam Chair.
I believe the question is, you would like to know who is eligible to participate in this graduation incentives program.
Yes.
Under 124D68. I have the eligibility requirements up right here. A pupil under the age of 21 who meets the requirements is eligible to participate in graduation incentives program if they perform a substantially below the performance level for pupils of the same age in a locally determined achievement test. Is behind satisfactorily completing coursework and obtaining credits for graduation, is pregnant or is a parent, has been assessed as chemically dependent, has been excluded or expelled, or has been referred by a school district for enrollment in an eligible program pursuant to. That's the extent of it.
And what did we do for that graduation incentive? Allowed them to do what? Was that a particular school or construct that was, if they're participating in the graduation incentives program, what is the program? This is the eligibility.
Yes.
Can you give us a little definition there?
Yeah, one moment, Madam Chair. I'm going to have to review this a little bit further.
I believe that the MDE is actually here, and it looks like he really would like to answer that question.
Okay. So. Mr. McHenry, welcome.
I'm not sure if I want him to answer the question, but I...
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Department of Education. Just to the question on what that means for ALCs, is it means that they are exempt from the graduation requirement for determining AYP. However, the data, the student totals for the ALC will go back to the overall district. So if you have 10 students who meet the graduation requirement at the ALC and 5 students who don't, all 15, the ALC will be waived for the computation of the graduation rate at that individual site. But at the district level, it will be accounted under the entire students under that district.
But what that's answering my first question. The current one was we've heard the eligibility to participate in the graduation incentives program. What's your take on what the graduation incentives program is?
Madam Chair, members, it makes the students eligible to attend the ALC.
Okay, so that's the entree to area learning centers. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Thank you. Does that help anybody else in thinking about the wording and what we're doing here? Mr. McHenry.
And Madam Chair, if I could, there was just a couple other things just to add to this. Just want to thank Senator Harrington for bringing this bill forward. I think this is an important discussion. We have met with Ms. Anderson and others on this discussion, and I think that's something that, as a department, that we are eager to continue working with them and other schools. We understand that they are serving a population that isn't traditional, and we appreciate the work they have been doing. Issues.
Having said that, you're kind of leading up to something. So, what position is the department taking?
And Madam Chair, I appreciate that. Having said that, you took the words out of my mouth. Some of the conversations we've had is that what's happened here and what we've had is the worry of what's going to happen under the waiver. Under the waiver, there's a different accountability system. So currently we are, before the waiver, we are calculating AYP. and we will continue to calculate AYP. Under the waiver, schools will be they will be calculated in measurements under a different rating, the multiple measurements rating. They'll calculate proficiency, they'll calculate growth, they'll calculate the achievement gap, and they'll calculate graduation rates for schools that that applies to. And those are being high schools. All schools are that's applicable to all schools, including ALCs. ALCs do not get their graduation rate waived from the MMR. Their graduation rate
from
is waived.
MMR.
The Madam Chair, the multiple measures rating that I had just mentioned.
That's a part of the waiver.
Madam Chair, correct.
And that was a federal requirement that you include that in the request for the waiver.
Madam Chair, correct.
So if schools organized in ways that under our current law are now waived from that, they're actually brought into and having to meet a tougher standard under the waiver than they did before?
Madam Chair, members, they'll be held to the same standards of AYP. They'll still be requirement under AYP. But the graduation standards on a federal level are four-year graduation rates, and that will apply to all schools.
So what was waived?
Madam Chair?
I mean, that was partly rhetorical, but it's a heavier challenge on those who are trying to tackle and work with some of the most difficult challenges, and yet committed to finding some success and helping these young people find success. But they're not going to do it in the traditional ways.
Madam Chair, that is correct. I think what is waived is the traditional, or not the traditional, the for the last 10 years there were manners in which interventions of what districts had to do to intervene, whether it was firing a principal, firing the teachers, having a specific school turnaround plan. Under the waiver, there's a little bit more flexibility where the department does work with the school. It works with the parents. It works with the community to develop a turnaround strategy. So it's not going to be the kind of the top-down hammer down that we had under NCLB. It's more of a partnership and working to find out what's the best turnaround strategy for that school.
So, what are you saying relation to this bill? Are you supporting it? What difficulty would you have if it were to pass?
Madam Chair, members, as is, we are not supporting the bill. We, from the department perspective, is that regardless of the challenges that any student may face, we still want to have accountability standards, and we still encourage students to reach for the highest level possible, and we want to be as supportive as possible. Under this, it's asking to be treated like an ALC. We're not exactly sure what that means under the waiver and how that's going to help the situation that Ms. Anderson had just brought forward here. They were discussing SIG grants, which was an application through the federal government, not through our department. But under the waiver, that this language I don't think is going to solve the problem that they brought forward in front of you today.
So what in your view does this language do?
Madam Chair, members, if it treats them like ALCs, that they might have a different graduation requirement under AYP. However, it doesn't determine who will be accountable for that graduation rate. Like I said before, under ALCs, those graduation numbers go back to the district. Under the individual charter schools, we're unsure where that data will go to.
So the graduation rate is the key.
Madam Chair, members,
how can you possibly, I think in some of these, how can you possibly, even do that, achieve that mathematically?
And Madam Chair, members, I think, and I apologize, we don't have our federal compliance person here today with us. But I think what I've been told is what and how this happens is you need a certain amount of students per group in order to be eligible under these measurements. If there's not enough students that start at the specific time in order to gain the four-year graduation rate, that they would not be part of that subgroup. So therefore, sometimes the numbers in ALCs don't rise to the amount of the necessary number of students in order to have the proper measurements. So therefore, we're not able to identify them as priority or focus schools. And I think under some of the circumstances here that that ends up being the same case as well.
It's just another situation where it raises the issue as to whether the federal government is actually doing something that has the potential of helping students grow and achieve. If we throw heavier obstacles that when you hear the story even of this young woman that was here and essentially rejected, hated school, didn't want to be a part of anything, to get to a point where you start to believe that you can do something and are willing to pursue on that path, that takes some time. There aren't credits attached to that. It doesn't fit into the boxes, and I think that's one of the things that I was hearing here in terms of why we need flexibility in our charter schools, and we shouldn't be working toward things that are going to make them more rigid than negate the ability of serving young people and bringing them to a point where they maybe they haven't even graduated, but they're functioning far better and may surprise us in how far they can go.
And Madam Chair, members, I think I preface my statements before when I started, and I think we completely agree with you on that. Obviously, there are different routes that people take, and we want to be as supportive as we can. Under the waiver, schools that are identified as priority and focus schools, they're going to have a different way that the department helps to intervene to help them have different turnaround strategies. And
so what's the department proposed to do to deal with this? Because you said the department can help. How? I mean, the people in the department, I don't mean to be critical, but this mm-hmm. is a bureaucracy that does not necessarily have people that have even had experience working with some of these challenging students. How are they going to help them turn around?
Well, Madam Chair, members, I think the first thing that a school to be involved in the under the waiver, they need to be identified as a priority or a focus school. We don't have that list completed yet. It should be out in May is when we feel that final list will be out. We do have an area that deals with turnaround different strategies, and they work with the actual schools, they work with the parents, they work with businesses to help define what it is that's going to help them turn around to succeed, to have better performance under their multiple measures.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair and Mr. McHenry, sounds like we're kind of catching you guys at a time where things are in flux, and so that's part of the hesitation because of the newness. But if you step back and you think that the mantra is do no harm, seems like what Senator Harrington's proposing, even if once you get all that worked out, that how would this particular bill harm? It seems like it has the potential for providing some relief. We might not find out once you get through everything that it did provide that relief, but it doesn't seem like it could do any harm, could it?
Mr. McHenry.
Madam Chair, members, I think what we're unsure of is what this obviously we do have our accountability system, and we do have federal standards that we have to meet, and we do need to be accountable for students across the state. If we do not have I don't want to say a way to measure, but if we're waiving a requirement of whether it's a graduation rate or not, that's one measurement that we're not going to have. I don't think that's something that is going to be deemed favorable from the federal government.
And so what are the consequences of that? If they don't deem it favorable, now we're on a one-year waiver, they might not renew that and make us do something else or take away the money, or what's the consequences of our making a decision to try to help this function?
Madam Chair, members, it is a three-year waiver.
It is 3 years.
It is a three-year waiver.
Where did I get the notion it was just a one-year and then had to be renewed?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you for straightening me out.
But as far as what the implications are, I can't say for certain what that means from the federal what the federal standards of that will mean. I don't know if that means money is withheld or not. It's something I can definitely follow up on.
Great, thanks, Senator Bonner.
Yeah, I'll follow up on that, Madam Chair, Mr. McHenry. I think this just says that they'd be treated the same as we treat the area learning centers for the purpose of all that. So if, with the new waiver, we can no longer exempt the area learning centers and that ends up to be the case, then it wouldn't, in fact, solve this problem. That's why I asked the question about harm. You know, we don't know. It might not solve it because you might not be exempting area learning centers in the future. So all this legislation is doing is putting them in the same bucket, however you treat them, and I think that's what they're asking for, and that's why I don't understand why you would mind that.
Madam Chair, members, I think the two issues that we want to separate here, under the waiver, there's the multiple measures that includes the four measurements, proficiency, the achievement gap, growth, and the graduation rate. The graduation rate under the multiple measures is a four-year graduation rate. AYP was the measurements that we were using before under NCLB that we continue to use. ALCs, what they had is a wave from the graduation rate for AYP. Mm-hmm. The numbers on the graduation rates under AYP for the ALCs still went back to the total number of students of the district that the ALC serves. Mm-hmm. The issue that we're seeing here, and so when we get back to the MMR, the every charter school, all the public schools and ALCs are still going to be subject to this MMR. No, there's no way, there's not a way from that. If we do this, what we're doing is waiving a graduation requirement, but we're not where are we waiving it to is what we're getting at.
It doesn't waive it.
It's not going back to it's not being accounted for at other districts. It's not being accounted for at the individual charter school level. And I think that's where we're kind of stuck.
May I respond?
Yeah, Ms. Anderson.
Aggressive question. We don't in any way object to accountability and to receiving an MMR. We know that we're going to be taking the same tests and we're going to be having our graduates counted and we're going to have our growth counted and our achievement gap, our ability to close that gap measured. Every school will get an MMR. What we object to is the consequences being the same as they would be for a regular high school when we clearly serve the population of an area learning center. So it's really the consequences that are the objectionable part of this, not the the receiving of an MMR score. And the reason that I brought up the SIG grant before was that was the first example that we had of this kind of thing being what we believe misapplied. And we see a future of these kinds of things being misapplied unless we start to do something about it now. No Child Left Behind is being rewritten. So we could be dealing with this issue over and over again unless we figure out together how to solve this.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Mr. Kennedy, do you want to?
And Madam Chair, I think, and I'm sorry I didn't complete the last slide, that ALCs are still subject to the MMR. So the school here would be subject to the MMR. They're not being exempted from any of the, I don't want to say consequences, but any of the ability of being labeled a priority or focus school.
Okay, but now she said that they're, that's not what they're asking for. They would still be in the MMR. So what's the problem?
What are the consequences?
What are the consequences?
Shut down.
Madam Chair, are you asking what the consequences are of the, under the measurements of the MMR, or?
Yes.
The consequences under the MMR is just how you're ranked throughout each of the four different categories. The the lowest 5% performing schools will be labeled priority schools, and then the 10 schools with the highest achievement, or 10% of the schools with the highest achievement gap, will be labeled focus schools. And those are the schools that the some of the turnaround strategies the department will be working with the schools and the communities on how to do that.
So that's the new ranking under the waiver. Okay. Well, Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would these consequences include the potential, because they are a charter school, closing them down, which would not necessarily happen at an ALC because they're absorbed by an entire school district, but a charter school is the school district, which I think is a considerably more severe consequence.
Madam Chair, members, there is not a set defined what is eligible and what is not eligible. There's not a definition of we need to fire a principal, we need to fire our teachers, we need to close the school down. Obviously, I think anything could be an option. But that's something that is worked on with the school, it's worked on with the community, it's worked on with the parents and with the kids, and those of interest, of finding out what's best for this act, what's best for this school. And I think that's what it's different than what has been happening in the past under NCLB, where there were specific requirements of what here are the four different things you can or can't do. So there's not I can't say that the yes or no, it won't happen. But that's something that's worked on between the school, between the department, between the community, of what's best for the school.
So, Mr. McHenry, when you look at these results here, who's making these decisions relative to these consequences?
Madam Chair, members, I think that's something that comes, I think the department plays a supporting role with the school, and with the employees at the school, with the parents of the children and the children, and other community members who have a stake in their community school.
So, Senator Wolf?
Madam Chair, well, if they are that big a role in determining the future of the school, my guess would we wouldn't have to worry about the school. Do they have the power to keep that school open and continue functioning, or is that going to be a greater possibility that the department would be able to affect that?
Madam Chair, Senator Wolf.
Mr. McHenry.
It's not in our best interest to come in and have a unilateral answer of a turnaround strategy. So it's not our goal to come in and say, here's an option to, let's just shut this school down. Obviously, you go if a school's a focus school or priority school, there are some best practices identified for turnaround strategies. However, when the department is going in with the community, with the parents, obviously there are things that are taken into account. If a school that is serving a different population, that there might have some different strategies moving forward, and I think all those are taken into account.
So what happens to these schools? Let's say that we don't act on this and they aren't treated like area learning centers. Then what happens? What's the consequence? Now, they're already agreeing to the MMR or whatever. I've already forgotten what the acronym stands for.
The vaccination.
It's a vaccination.
It is a vaccination, right?
So because you don't like this, you want it to stay the same, and what are the consequences of it staying the same for schools that are functioning and serving a need but may not be able to follow the same steps or trappings that we're needing to do to meet the waiver?
Madam Chair, members, I'm not sure how to answer that. under the waiver, schools that are identified as priority or focus schools, obviously, and there's reward schools for the higher performing schools that are identified, and some schools aren't identified. To say what the consequences are, it's really difficult to say. I think each school will know they'll have more than just one way of measurement to determine how they're performing. Maybe that can help them, in their curriculum or how they're teaching or how they're serving their students. They can take the measurements and use them to the best way they feel they'd like to use it for.
We've got some other people here that are interested. Maybe you can get you see the line of questioning and try. I think attempt that I have to understand. I don't know if all of you have got this. The rest of you have got this under.
Madam Chair, could I call up Tony Simmons?
Mr. Piccolo, I see, is here. Perhaps he can respond too. But Senator Chamberlain, did you have a question, or do you have this figured out?
No, Madam Chair, I don't. I'm in your tents. I really don't.
Madam Chair, if I may,
yes.
My name is Tony Simmons. I'm the program director at High School for Recording Arts.
And I'd like to try Mr. Simmons.
Hi. I'd like to try to bring some clarity to this. Back during the SIG grant, when they were identifying the persistently lowest achieving schools, like my colleague Ms. Anderson said, for the most part, and I think there may have been one exception, ALCs were exempt from that list. So what you had were major district schools and a number of charter schools like ours, which serve this population. That it makes sense in terms of exempting them from the list, because if you believe the department now that ALCs are not going to be exempt, which I don't believe, I've heard contradictory things from the department that they don't know who's on the list yet. Maybe ALCs will be, maybe they won't. But let's assume that ALCs are on the list. Priority schools might sound benign, but what priority schools are is the bottom 5% of schools in the state. That's what the media is going to describe it as, and the term is going to be, these are bad schools. So imagine ALCs being included on that list, and you have a bunch of ALCs and schools like High School for Recording Arts that serve this population considered the 5% worst schools in the state. It just doesn't make any sense, because we will be judged as bad schools, not for how good of a job we're doing, but for whom we're serving. The example best in coming to that conclusion, one of the criteria that they're looking at is graduation rate. They say you have to have a 4-year on-time graduation rate. If we're serving overage, undercredited students, if those are the students coming to us, we take the first thing right there. The area learning centers do as well. Now, they've been exempt before because they say the area learning centers can move their test scores to the district. The districts are large. They could absorb those numbers, and it protects the ALC from those consequences, like what happened the last time with SIG. They weren't on the list. But that pure technicality doesn't address the very fact that it's really about who are we serving. We still have those students. We still serve a public purpose in turning around those students' lives so that they become productive citizens, taxpaying citizens, as opposed to being dropout and lifetime dependents on the state, more than likely. If the department is saying today to this committee that because of a federal, waiver, that Minnesota is going to identify the schools that are part of the solution to the dropout problem as the worst schools in the state, I think this committee needs to address that and fix that.
Thank you. Very, very
Madam Chair.
Succinctly and aptly stated. Thank you.
I have it figured out.
Senator Chamberlain.
For those that are remain standing here, I put full faith and credit in these people to do what they got to do.
God bless you guys over there, but you're a big place over there. And what you set up here, AYP, MMR, and waivers and ALCs, these people are doing their job, and that's all they want to do. So I would say let's move this bill and let them give them their chance to do their thing.
Madam Chair, I have an author's oral amendment to take one. It's very simple and very short. I promise you that I would talk very little.
Be sure
so.
You don't muck up. That was a pretty good closing.
I just want this.
When you've sold.
It's sold, and I think you're going to like this even better. It's on line 1.14, and all it says is, rather than where it says 60%, it says 75%. So it ups the standard, actually. It is not lowering the standard. It's actually requiring the school to actually hit an even higher standard in terms of the percentage of their students that have that graduation incentive.
Okay.
It will bring it in line with House language, so I believe it allows us to have two complementary bills, and it's a very simple amendment.
Okay. Senator Wolf?
Madam Chair, I just want to make sure before we vote on this, we have a couple other testifiers that have been waiting to testify, and if for no other reason, I would like to give them the experience of testifying before a Senate committee.
All right.
Thank you so much, Senator. We have the young lady from Jennings School was incredible. We brought in two young men, and I just want to acknowledge that David Ellis, the founder of High School for Recording Arts, is here in the audience as well. But I'd like to first call up Dominique Farrar to testify.
Yeah. Is this thing on? Okay, cool. Hi.
Well,
hi, everyone.
While you're settling in, this was an author's amendment to go from 60 to 75. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Sweet.
Welcome.
Cool.
Gentlemen?
Hi, everyone. My name is Dominique Farrar. I'm 20 years old, and I am a senior at the High School for Recording Arts. And by the way, I'm graduating in June. Hurrah.
Right.
basically, just a little bit about myself. I had I dropped out of school twice. And at the traditional school I was going to prior to High School for Recording Arts. Upon enrollment, I had a daughter. And the reason as to why I dropped out twice was because taking care of her, handling child support, and, you know, adult things that I had to do as a child. They were kind of, you know, got in the way of getting an education. And upon enrollment in the High School for Recording Arts, I learned that education is more important than I thought it was at first. Because I was working at a pace where I would be working like this for the rest of my life. Nothing would change. But just the care from the teachers and them really telling me and coaching me and showing that if you build upon education, you learn. The more you learn, the better of a chance you'll have to get a higher paying job, or to get, you know, to basically to elevate and become more and be more. And some things that we've been working on at the High School for Recording Arts, I just want to throw this out there because I got the shirt on. We've been working on the dropout rate statistic. Did you guys know every 26 seconds someone drops out of school? Terrible statistic. We've been working on that with State Farm. We've gone on CNN and Fox 9 and traveled across the country. We've made music just trying to really raise awareness about the dropout rates and how important education is. And that education can be cool too, you know? So that's basically some things that my personal story, my personal struggle with education, and the reason why I believe that schools like the High School for Recording Arts and Jennings and things like that can be a really, really... really, I want to think of a really cool word for you guys. Can be a really, you guys know what I'm trying to say. Can be a really big help. And it can be a really big help and show that every student needs to learn, but every student learns a different kind of way. And schools like High School for Recording Arts and Jennings really, you know, highlight those different kind of ways of learning. I also come bearing gifts for everybody.
That's not
free. Free. But if you like to make a generous donation.
This is not a bribe.
No.
Show me the CD.
I'll get these to you guys.
6 seconds.
Nice
thanks.
Music.
Right.
Lastly, I'd like to call Mr. Johnson.
Oh, we have
Hi, everyone. My name is Montrell Johnson. I'm a senior at High School for Recording Arts.
I've been going to high school for recording arts approximately. This will be my second year. We graduating this June with Domino. And when I came into high school for recording arts, I was a junior last year with zero credits. They gave me a chance to catch up, and catching up to me was basically like everything I ever dreamed for. In a public high school, I never had the chance to basically earn credits. I'm academically smart, but I hung around the wrong crowd. In high school for recording arts, it gave me a chance to want to learn. The teachers, they actually care. And I think charter school is where it helps kids like me and Domino at, is when we have the setbacks, it sets us right back on track. And what HSRA did for me, it's just amazing. Like, I don't think I would be able to go to any high school and succeed in life, period, college or any of that, if it wasn't for HSRA. It's crazy. But I was a freshman with no credits last year, but supposed to be a junior. Now I'm a senior and I'm on track to graduating, and it's just awesome. Things I like about our school is basically regular schools get out at about 3 o'clock. In our school, they hold us to about 5:30. Now, when I first came to the school, I know Domino felt my pain. I was like, oh, I got to be here till 5:30. Everyone gets out at 3 o'clock. I'm like, I got to get out of here. And they basically hold us. And I realize it's good because at 3 o'clock, there's a lot of bad things going on out there. And I just wanted to get out, you know, and just be with the rest of the youth. But they actually, like, I wouldn't want to say babysit us, but they're there to guide us and walk us through. And I think schools like Jennings and HSRA, they're actually there to help. And that's the big picture. And that's just the things I like about it. You know, after school programs, 7 days a week, I can go to HSRA on the weekends, work on projects, work on everything from voiceovers to the radio show, 26 seconds. We address issues like kids dropping out, be more than a statistic. Everything's just, my life is back on track through the HSRA. And I just don't know what I would do without it.
Thank you so much.
That's on that note, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Harrington moves Senate file 2460 as amended, be recommended to pass, and to the floor.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed. And thank you all very much and for your patience of hanging in there this long. This is the end. This is our last meeting of the Education Committee before the second deadline. And I'm not sure what comes in the next week or so, but we'll stay tuned.
Well, just about.
Any adjourned?
Meeting is
adjourned. I saw that. All right.
You're doing like a Charlie Chaplin.
Right.
Am I allowed to keep it on?